Jesus Christ. He is the truly faithful one. He is the one who has stuck with it until the end. You may recall that in the book of John, in the Gospels, that Jesus says in chapter 19, verse 30, just before he gives up his spirit, he says, "It is finished. It is finished." Now, that statement is a loaded statement. There's a lot that goes into that statement. But the thread that I want to draw out today is that Jesus is truly faithful. He has seen the entire project through until the end. There are certain people in the Bible that are regarded very highly, very high esteem given to them, even by God. But I would like to speak of Jesus as ultimately being the only hero in the length and width and breadth of the Bible. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that nobody ever did anything good ever, but I am saying that Jesus is the only one who, in the ultimate sense, was from front to back, beginning to end, without flaw, without error, without sin, and completed his tasks, all of them, as he ought to do. Of course, the archetypal anti-hero in that way would be the prophet Jonah. And Jonah, he did what he was called to do. You know, he brought it to its completion point. He finished what he was supposed to do. But he was so unfaithful to the task the entire length and breadth of that thing. The entire time, you know, God says, here, do this project that I have for you. And Jonah, a disappointing effort all the way through. But he did it, that is to say, the task that was given to him. He did complete the task. Then there are others. So Jonah, by the way, I don't think is any hero at all. There are others who did their task. They did what they were supposed to do, and they even made a good showing of it. Some of these are going to be perhaps Daniel. He may be on the upper echelon. I have heard some who say Joseph, but I really think that Joseph did a few things that were treacherous, maybe even. Not Joseph, the surrogate father of Jesus, the adoptive father, maybe that's a better way of putting it, of Jesus. But Joseph, the son of Israel, son of Jacob. There are plenty of characters in the Bible who are very obviously flawed. Good folks, really. I mean, if you get down to it, what I am absolutely not doing is comparing myself to anybody. I don't compare to anybody. I really don't. But, you know, one of the obvious ones that people love to point out, I'll just use it because David. Because it's such an obvious one that many pulpits have spent some time on, David. He was a man after God's own heart. He was a good fella. He was a good king. He wrote psalms. He was faithful in a lot of ways. But man, David was also pretty flawed, pretty human. He was a white hat with plenty of gray. You get the point of what it is that I'm saying. I mean, and everybody likes to point out Bathsheba, but Bathsheba was hardly the only instance of David going afoul there are several of these. There are several. Noah, you know, Noah, he was a good egg. He was. But he did go afoul. He was not pure as the driven snow. There were a few places here and there. But none are without flaw. None are without sin. We know that. Scripture tells us so. That there's none who is altogether right, except for Jesus. I don't want to just simply pick on mankind. I do want to say that Jesus is altogether unique. There is something just fantastic about following a king who is so very worthy. Having a king, you are kind of in the place where, you know, if he's your king, then you obey him. You follow him. If he is a bad king, then you overthrow him. You usurp him, perhaps. You have a coup of some kind. You get another king in place. Or maybe perhaps a democratic republic instead of a king. But if you have a king, you are pretty much in the place where you are set to be obedient to the king. Jesus is the king. The wonderful thing about Jesus being the king is that it's not simply some kind of a despotic tyrant, powerful and all terrible, who demands service and obedience. Jesus is worthy of honor, worthy of glory, worthy of praise. He is worthy of being obeyed. This is Well-Placed Faith, an hour-long program about life, liberty, and the pursuit of Jesus Christ. Every week, we come to you and we have something of a one-sided discussion, for the now, on Jesus, his attributes, his words, teachings from the Bible, with an attempt at trying to help people to see what does the Bible say. There is a bent on our part. We, here at Well-Placed Faith, we are already convinced. We have done the legwork. We have come to conclusions. We are biased at this point. We have here, those of us who are part of Well-Placed Faith, we have given our hearts and our lives and our fealty, our fidelities are his. We have our allegiances to Jesus because we have thought about it, because we have looked into it, because our skepticisms have been answered. Not because we are unthinking or because we are just, you know, pushovers, or because we've simply made some kind of an emotional response based on a wish fulfillment or something. So we want to give people an opportunity to think through the Bible and think through the claims of the Bible, and then have an opportunity to subject yourself, surrender yourself to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Hopefully you find yourself being evangelized. You find yourself being invited and called upon to make a decision for Jesus Christ. He is the King. He is the Messiah. He is the Lord. He is our God incarnate in the flesh. God has come to us here on this earthly, terrestrial plane, and he's lived a perfect, sinless, flawless life, and in that, he is the perfect one to obey. Beyond that, this perfect life of his actually set him up to being a perfect sacrifice. Now, human sacrifice is not a good thing. And if you've heard before, I've talked about human sacrifice, so I won't necessarily go over all of that again. But he was sacrificed. He was killed as a sacrifice. And as it turns out, Jesus was perfect and brought about in his sacrifice accord with God. We have an opportunity based on what it is that Jesus did, his faithfulness, his not just merely an example. Jesus is an example, yes, but not merely his example. Jesus actually accomplished salvation in his death, in his burial, his resurrection. And there's an interesting point right there. Jesus was faithful unto death, and then death was reversed. He rose from the dead. Rising from the dead, if we are his, we are justified by his rising. He is our head, and he has defeated death, and we as his are rescued. Not spared, but rescued from death and from the penalty of sin. Forgiveness is ours through Jesus. The covenant that he worked out for us, on our behalf, to our benefit, for our favor, involves trusting him and believing him that the fullness of our salvation is accomplished in and through him. Some of it is yet to be actualized, because we have not yet died and we have not yet come unto the judgment. But the salvation is granted. It is given to us. And we can know in advance how Judgment Day is going to turn out because we have believed him and he has rescued us already from the judgment that is to come. In this covenant that we are bound up with, God himself comes to the believer, and God himself in the Holy Spirit abides with us and changes us, changes our hearts, changes our minds, changes our lives, changes our desires, gives us the power to walk in accordance with the Lord's will. But beyond that, demonstrates God himself coming to abide with us and live with us, in us, through us, demonstrates his covenantal promise that he would never leave us nor forsake us. The relationship is secure. We have a secured relationship with him. All of this is available, and so much more. But I don't want people simply saying, oh, well, the benefits are thus. My intention is for you to see that Jesus is not just a source of benefits. He is a source of benefits, to be sure. Rewards was his idea. No embarrassment or shame in that. But I want you to come to Jesus because of Jesus. I want you to come to Jesus because even if there was no heaven or hell or anything, Jesus is still worthy of you following him. Even if you don't get any bennies, no perquisites for your loyalty. Let's say that the only thing that you get from your loyalty to Jesus is an opportunity to die for his name. He is a good master, and he is worthy of being praised unto death, being followed unto death. Now, by the way, there actually are, as I said, benefits, rewards to following him. You will not stay in the grave. There will be a resurrection. We are assured of this by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, when the resurrection happens, if you belong to Jesus and if you are filled with the Holy Spirit, then at the resurrection, you will belong to Jesus still, and you will be rescued, and you will come to know the fullness of your redemption. There is salvation in Jesus Christ. Salvation is, we who do theologies, the systematic theology breaks salvation up into three portions, and in some sense it's artificial, but it helps us with categories. We think in categories, but the entirety of it is salvation. So there is justification, believing on the Lord and being justified, coming before the judgment throne and having the judge pronounce in our favor. You, the court has found in your favor, you are justified. Being justified then leads to, that's the initial move, being justified then leads to sanctification. Sanctification is a lifelong process of change, a lifelong process of being made to be more and more like Jesus. Catching the drift of what holiness is all about, being separate and distinct from the world. And then after sanctification is glorification. And glorification will happen in by dying and going through the judgment, and on the other side of judgment you are fully brought into your covenant expression, the renewed, redeemed, resurrected self. That will be glorification, when you actually are ruling on the part of Jesus in its ultimate way, in the ultimate sense. That's going to be glorification. All three of those things are stepwise, we could say. I'm oversimplifying, please understand. Are stepwise the way that salvation works. Salvation, we oftentimes treat it like it's justification. It is, but it's more than that. Some who have understanding will recognize that though we are saved and we are assured of salvation and we are promised our salvation, it's not until we've been glorified that we are actually saved. So salvation is glorification. And if you're a really bright spark, you will understand and even appreciate that if you are saved at justification and you are saved at glorification, that whole in-between section there, you're saved as well. So salvation spans from that initial decision for Jesus. When you join the covenant through Jesus and are filled with the Holy Spirit, all the way through until glorification. That is salvation. And I am supposing, trying to find words for it, that salvation could still be appreciated through eternity, but that looks a little something different from just salvation. The terms begin to wiggle under our fingers or under our thumb, so that salvation is maybe not the best way of saying it. Having been saved, we then are the eternal servants of the Lord in His service for His purposes. And at that point, it might be better to talk about ruling rather than being saved. At that point, it would be better, I think, to speak in terms of ruling properly, wisely. Jesus is the one who does all of this. He's the one who completes all of this. He's the author and the perfecter of all of this. He's the one who finishes all of it. He's faithful unto the end. He is the one who completes it all. And He doesn't try to fade out or wiggle away or escape the responsibility of or anything like that. He is a real hero, Jesus. He is worthy of respect. If you've ever met somebody that was worthy of respect, Jesus is someone who is astoundingly worthy of respect. He does what he does rightly. He gets it right, this Jesus does, all the time. And he does the right thing, the right way, for the right reason. And I am filled with wonder and awe and respect and reverence for this Jesus. I would like for you to appreciate Jesus. Allow for that approval. That will turn into a worship, if you will allow for it, to see just how wonderful he is, what it is that he has done, what it is that he has accomplished. And the dark backdrop to how wonderful Jesus is all of the rest of humankind who has come up short and failed. And even the best come up short. It's a reality. If you go to Hebrews chapter 11, Hebrews chapter 11 is a strange chapter. It's filled with names of people. It's filled with the activities of people. It's filled with flawed people. And these flawed people are demonstrations of flawed people who believed, believing unto action, and these obediences sometimes turned out for, we'll call it the good or for the benefit of the believer, and sometimes their faith and their faithfulness ended up in their demise. Now, every one of the people named in chapter 11 has died, but these guys, and women, there's women in there too, they are faithful, but you kind of have to say faithful, and then there were those occasions where they came up short. But there are good people, fine people, in the book of Hebrews chapter 11. If you get the opportunity, read through Hebrews chapter 11, and you'll see that these people believed, and believing, they were compelled, and in their being compelled, they acted, and their actions were regarded as being good things. What Hebrews chapter 11 is not trying to do is point out the flaws of people. The Bible does a really good job of pointing out the flaws of people. I like that. I like that. That it doesn't try to pull one over. It doesn't try to shine us on. The only person that really doesn't have that would be Jesus. And even there, the places where there could be scrutiny, the Bible has no problem with exposing Jesus for scrutiny for the things that he did, for the things that he has done. But going from Jesus being the one who completes things, is faithful all the way through, and seeing that through with the backdrop of other faithful humans aren't faithful the same way that Jesus is. Yeah, they're faithful, but it's like faithful light, right? The L-I-T-E, the low-calorie version of faithfulness. Just some troubles there. So I've said before, okay, it was, I believe, 2 weeks ago, I was talking about people not being the heroes, Jesus being the only hero. Then I got a question, and so I answered the question last week. This week, I want to finish up with what I was saying. We're going to talk about Elijah. So you should be able to find these recordings on wellplacedfaith.org. You're welcome to go visit the website, and there it's going to be populated with more things. Forgive me, the team that's at work, they are a faithful lot. They are doing what they can do. A lot of this is dependent upon my availability, and my schedule is extraordinarily tight, and I'm a very busy person. All those are excuses. They're good excuses. They are. They're good excuses. They're real. But they're excuses all the same. But these recordings should show up on wellplacedfaith.org. If you wanted to go back and listen to, re-listen to listen for the first time to some of the previous messages, you're welcome to do that. Those are there. Those are available for you. And as opportunity arises, we'll get more content on there. But there's enough that you could listen for a long time. There's years worth of messages on there, one a week messages. So you should be able to sleep well. If you listen to one of those, you can go to sleep nicely and comfortably. We'll help you with your insomnia for many nights to come, if you'll come and listen on wellplacedfaith.org. So, going to 1 Kings, and chapter 19 is where we're going to be when I start pointing some stuff out, but in order to do that, let's actually start in 1 Kings chapter 18. In 1 Kings chapter 18, what we see is Elijah, and we could start much earlier, actually, okay, because there's been a drought, and Elijah predicted it, and there are some who might even say, oh, he caused it, and Elijah is performing miracles, and he is a mighty man of God, doing all kinds of incredible things. There are miracles coming from this man, coming from God through this man. You get what I'm saying? And God shows himself faithful to Israel, to Judah. He shows himself faithful to Elijah. He shows himself faithful to the kings. And that doesn't just mean that everybody benefits all over the place. God, if he says, look, if you obey me, then this is going to happen. But if you don't obey me, then that is going to happen. If the people are not obedient, when that happens, the contrary, the other thing, when that happens, that's God being faithful. I told you that I would do this, and I did it. I told you this is what was going to happen, and that is in fact what happened. God is being faithful. It is not merely when things are going well for us that God is being faithful. When God says, if you go astray, you can expect 1, 2, and 3, these consequences, and when 1, 2, and 3 come along, that's God being faithful. He said that this was going to happen. So, in chapter 18, there's a really great story. I like the story, okay? And Elijah is a dude, if I can say it that way. He's a dude. He goes before Ahab and presents himself there, but he also presents himself before not only Ahab, the king of Israel, okay, so that's kind of a big gun, but then he also goes before the big wheels of Israel in the cult, in the cultists. He says, gather together 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah, and these, they eat at Jezebel's table. So now you got Jezebel too. Man, she was a piece of work, that one. And she was an angry and a bitter and a sullen woman who had power and money and was not afraid of treachery and murder and these sort of things. So chapter 18, verse 20, Ahab sent a messenger among all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people, they didn't answer him a word. Now, it should have been done right there. The people should have said, well, you know what? Baal is a big bunch of baloney. And Asherah is a big bunch of baloney. And the only true living God is the God of Israel, Yahweh, the Lord. And so that tears it. And they should have repented and turned, but they didn't. Okay, they didn't. And maybe somebody's going to say, you know, that's too Pollyanna-esque. Okay, fine, whatever. Instead, Elijah says to the people, I alone am left, a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now, let them... Okay, folks, I want you to see if you pick up on this, okay? Now, let them give us two oxen, and let them choose one ox for themselves, and cut it up, and place it on the wood, and put no fire under it, and I will prepare the other ox, and lay it on the wood, and I will not put a fire under it. Okay, so here's the thing that I think is kind of funny. And it is reading between the lines, but when he says, now let them give us two oxen, the reason why he wants two oxen is, frankly, because he can't afford one. He doesn't have his own ox. He needs them to provide an ox for him. Isn't that funny? Okay, he doesn't have an ox. He actually needs them. Okay, guys, not only am I going to tell you to get bent, but I'm going to kind of make you like it, and you're going to pay for it. Okay, so Ahab, he's the king, and then you've got the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah, and this sort of hazy, shadowy background character of Jezebel. And then you got this one cat, Elijah, and he's going to stand alone. I just love the moxie of Elijah here. And he says, you guys provide it. You guys pay for it. You guys bring two oxen here, and I'll show you what's what. So you guys take an oxen, and you cut it up and put it over here, and I'll cut one up and prepare it and put it over here. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people said, whoopee-doopee, that a good idea. If you're familiar with the Go-Go Golfers, that's what they said. Whoopee-doopee, oh, that a good idea. Here, God is just a noun, right? Elijah is doing a great job of demoting the word God to being just a noun. Okay, let's actually figure out who God is, and then we can define the term. Now, I already know, so I'm going to go with the Lord, that he's God. You guys think it's Baal. Well, here's what we're going to do. We're just going to throw it out there and say, fine, God's a noun. That's all. Just a noun. And we're going to see which one of them adds life to that word. So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, go ahead. You guys choose an ox for yourself and you guys prepare it. Because there's many of you. You guys go right ahead. Get after it. And call on the name of your God and put no fire under it. Then they took the ox, which was given them, and they prepared it, and they called on the name of Baal from morning until noon. Oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, there was no one who answered, and they leaped about the altar which they made. It came about at noon that Elijah mocked them. Elijah, that's not very PC. You shouldn't make fun of people's non-gods. Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied, or gone aside, or is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be awakened. And that's not just precisely what the Hebrew says. But we'll let that one go. So, they cried with a loud voice. Remember, he mocked them. Okay, just remember that. So, anyhow, American sensitivities being what they are. Verse 28, so they cried with a loud voice, they cut themselves according to their customs with, even using like swords, not just like a knife or something, they used swords and lances until blood gushed out on them. When midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice. No one answered, and no one paid attention. Then Elijah, you know, the action got pretty dry there for a little while. The spectators were, you know, oh, well, it was fun watching the Raving Lunatics for a little bit, but you can only watch so much of that before it gets a little dry. Elijah said to all the people, "All right, my turn, come here." So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Israel shall be your name." Now, in that, okay, remember that he's standing before the king of Israel, so he takes 12 stones, not 10, 12, 12 stones. So he's actually kind of digging at Ahab here as well, letting him know, you know, maybe you're not nearly as legitimate as you think you are, mister. But he takes the 12 stones, right? "And with the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood, he cut the oxen in pieces, he laid it on the wood, and he said," "All right, do me a favor over here, you guys. Fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Okay, you guys did that. Now do it again. Do it a second time." They did it a second time. And he said, "Okay, do it a third time." They did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. Stop right there. Water was precious. Remember, there was a drought. There was a drought. He is so mocking their gods. He is so thumbing his nose at these people. "You guys, go ahead. You provide the oxen, you big wheels. You guys, bring some water. You guys got some water? You guys ready for this? You got some water? Take some water. Pour that on here. Do it again. Do it again. Do it again." You know, this was during a drought. So there's a drought, and you're using all of our water, Elijah. You're making a fool out of them, ultimately, is what he's going to do. So, okay, the water flowed around everything. Everything was all wet and damp, and it's hard to start water on fire. Water ought to be a pretty good fuel. It just isn't. So, at the time of the evening offering of the sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. You're worthy of being obeyed. I'm doing what you want done. Answer me, O Lord, answer me so that this people may know that you, O Yahweh, our God, and that you have turned their heart back again." Okay? We're about ready to see a demonstration. "Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, 'The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God.'" So Elijah says, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let any of them escape." So they seize them and they go ahead and they kill them. Okay? Now Elijah says to Ahab, "Hey, mister, you better go up and eat and drink, for there's the sound of the roar of a heavy shower." Ahab went up to eat and drink, but Elijah went up to the top of Carmel, and he crouched down on the earth, and he put his face between his knees. He wadded up in kind of a fetal position, but he's sitting down, and says to his servant, "Go up, take a look," and anyhow, he prays, and he keeps praying. He prays some more, and he then sends news. Ahab, you better hurry it up, because there's about ready to be some serious storms cutting loose. And Ahab rose and went to Jezreel. Then the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins, and he outran Ahab to Jezreel. He's on foot, and he's outrunning the horses. Pretty cool stuff. And so Ahab, he tells Jezebel, this is not the first time, but oh, what a man Ahab is. He goes and he whimpers to Jezebel every now and again. Now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Okay, right there, they should have been repenting, they should have been turning, they should have been fleeing from their false gods and turning to the true living God, the Lord of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." So, okay, here's the thing. Accomplishments, great feats, miracles, feats of power and wonder and amazement, fire, just incredible things. And now, Elijah, listen closely. He was afraid. I get it. Okay? He was afraid and arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die. He ran for his life, and now he has hit a bottoming out place. He's low. He requested for himself that he might die and said, "It is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better than my fathers." Here's the things, you know, if I'm going to die, you, Lord, at your hand, not at her hand, at yours. That's fine. I'll give my life over to you. So I have some respect for that. But it is a funny thing that he ran for his life, but now he finds himself in a place away from her, Jezebel, and now he is requesting that he might die. And he lay down and he went to sleep, and God recognizes that this is hard, and God provides for Elijah, and he is provided for, he's taken care of, he is blessed, he is encountered by God. And at Horeb, then he came to a cave, he lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Well, verse 4 said that he was there petitioning to die. Verse 10 says, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." So he says, "Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord." And behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great and strong wind was rending the mountains. And so Moses and Elijah both had the presence and the glory of the Lord passing by. And then this happens again in the future when Jesus presents himself in his glory, and Elijah and Moses are in the presence of the glory of the Lord with Jesus. But Peter and James and John are there as well on the mountaintop. So anyhow, they have a little bit of a conversation, and Elijah, he wraps his face and sits down, and again a voice comes to him, and, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Well, according to verse 4, he's there petitioning to die. Then he said, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've torn down your altars, they've killed the prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. The Lord said to him, now listen closely, okay? It is not just merely that Elijah hit a slump and he got low, all right? He says, the Lord says to him in 19:15 of 1 Kings here, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. It shall come about, the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha, shall put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So he departed from there. Now I want you to listen closely, okay? Here's the thing. I like Elijah. I like Elijah a lot. He is one of the heroes of the Bible, right? Except for that he's not. He is not like Jesus. Jesus was faithful to the end. I don't know if people know this about Elijah. I don't know if people put this together and see it. When the Lord said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram. He doesn't do it. Elijah does not do it. Elijah doesn't do it. Verse 16, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. He doesn't do it. Elijah does not do it. Elijah does not do the first thing. Elijah does not do the second thing. The third thing that God tells him that he is to do, in verse 16, he says, Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. Verse 19 says, so he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, while he was plowing with 12 pairs of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. And Elijah, okay, so there are a series of people out there. It's not like he's got 24 oxen on one plow. He's got workers that are there with him. They've all got their pair of yokesen. Right? They've all got their yoke of oxen, a pair of oxen, pardon me. And Elijah, he goes over to Elisha, who is plowing with the 12th pair of oxen. And Elijah passes over to him and threw his mantle on him. He only did the third thing, Elijah. He did not do the first thing. He did not do the second thing that God told him to do. He only did the third thing. That's all. He threw his mantle on Elisha and takes off. That's it. He left the oxen and ran after Elijah. Elisha did. And says, please let me kiss my father and my mother. Then I will follow you. And what Elijah says is, go back again. For what have I done to you? Can I translate that for you? Paraphrase it, really, is what I mean. He says, walks up to him, throws his mantle around him, and says, hey man, you've been drafted. Enjoy. It wasn't my idea. I didn't do anything to you. This was God's doing. I'm out. So, again, verse 19. He departed from there, and did not go and anoint Hazael king over Aram. He didn't do it. He doesn't do it. He does not go to Jehu, the son of Nimshi, and anoint him king over Israel. He does not do it ever. He doesn't do it. Instead, the third thing, God says, Elisha, the son of Shaphat, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. That's what Elijah does. Where's my replacement? Elisha's my replacement? That's what I'm doing. That's where I'm going. I'm going to cut right through the middle, and I'm just going to go straight there. And so he goes, and he finds him, and he throws his mantle around him, and Elisha comes running up to him and says, hey, wait for me. Wait for me. Let me go ahead and go and kiss my father and my mother, and I'll follow you. And Elijah's response to him is, hey, do what you got to do, man. Go back again, for what have I done to you? I didn't do anything. You've been drafted, buddy. Enjoy that. This isn't my doing. It wasn't my idea. This is God's idea. This is what he's doing. So you do whatever it is that you want to do. I'm done. I am cashing in my chips. I'm finished. So he returned from following him. He took the pair of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the implements of the oxen. Okay, so all of the plowing, the plow and all of the other stuff, he breaks that all up and he uses that for fire. He boils these two oxen, and the guys that he was working with, he says, here, eat up, guys, I gotta go. So they eat the sacrifice. He sacrificed them and boiled their flesh and with the implements of the oxen, and he gave it to the people, and they ate, and then he arose and followed Elijah and ministered to him. And what we see is that it is only just a short little while now before Elijah is dismissed by God. And Elisha steps up, and Elisha becomes the one who actually carries out these things that God had told Elijah to do, right? So if you go to 2 Kings chapter 8, it's 2 Kings chapter 8, verses 8 through 15. It's Elisha, not Elijah, it is Elisha who goes and anoints Hazael king over Aram. And that is at least 8 years later. At least 8 years later. And then in verse 16, it's not even Elisha who anoints Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. Elisha sends a prophet, and the prophet that he sends is the one who actually anoints him. That's 2 Kings chapter 9, verses 1 through 10. Elisha does that. Now listen to what I'm saying. The author of 1 Kings is not like a big dummy. He doesn't just simply write the wrong thing down. This is what God told him to do. He didn't do it. Elisha does. He takes the responsibility for it. Elijah, he's done. He simply hands off his duties and says, I'm finished. I'm cashing in my chips. I'm out of here. And I can't blame him, but what I can say is that he came up short there. Jesus didn't come up short anywhere. We're not called to be followers of Elijah. We're not called to be followers of Elisha. We're not called to be followers of John the Baptist. We're called to be followers of Jesus Christ. And we are called to be faithful. We are not going to be faithful the same way that Jesus was faithful. Those who were in the Hebrews chapter 11 Hall of Faith, as it is sometimes called, they were not faithful in the same way that Jesus was faithful. Jesus alone is Savior and Lord. He alone is the sufficient and the perfect one. He is worthy of being believed. He is worthy of being trusted. He is worthy of being followed. He is worthy of being obeyed. And in that, we can demonstrate that we understand that he is worthy of being worshipped. We draw close to Jesus, and we see Jesus. And as much as we may like others, Jesus is different, not just in degree, like he is more of something that others were. He is different in kind. He is a different category. He alone is worthy of being followed and trusted for salvation. Jesus is unique. He is better than you. He is better than me. But he is worthy not only of being better than we are and given a pat on the back and an attaboy, he's worthy of worship and praise. He's worthy of being trusted. What he has done to the uttermost. The love that he has loved us with, he has loved to the uttermost. Believing him, trusting him, that's well-placed faith.